Great. Good morning, everyone. I have some big shoes to fill here after that most recent presentation. My name is Carol McDonald. I am the Director of Strategic Partnerships of Planned Parenthood, where I've been for 10 years. And before I launch into what I've been asked to talk about, which is to sort of outline the framework of reproductive justice, which actually I think has been a lot of that has been alluded to in the previous presentation, I want to kind of take a second to locate myself a little bit, since this is a panel on the political geography of reproductive health rights and justice, and how I come to this work. I'm honored to be here. I come out of organizing and politics, so I am thrilled and honored to be in front of a room of public health professionals, because we see a lot, I think, of how the two disciplines interact and intersect, and I'll get into that in a little bit. I also have to say that I actually tried to punt on this panel when I was asked to serve on it, because I am not sure that I have the best perspective on reproductive justice. I can very much speak as a Black woman from the South, as an immigrant, as a single mom, and as a person who for 10 years has been working in the reproductive health and rights movement. But there are, I think, a lot of people who can really speak to and have lived through the development of reproductive justice as a framework. And even just sitting here with having Billy Avery in the room is just so also humbling, and I hope I do a good job. So I'm sure she'll correct me if I mess anything up. I want to talk a little bit about, again, geography, because, again, my family is we're from North Carolina, and my grandmother and my grandmother had 10 children, including my dad, and they grew up as sharecroppers on a tobacco farm in North Carolina. And I talk about both my mother and my father. My mother is from South America, and I talk about them when I describe them as coming from the kind of back-breaking, soul-crushing poverty, and within one generation, having moved out of that. It's sort of a very classic kind of American story. My grandmother had an eighth-grade education, but managed to put all ten children through college, half of them with advanced degrees. And so I am that first generation of or the second generation, sort of out of that really dark light of Southern oppression type poverty, and if you can relate to that experience, if you are coming from a poor background or a working class background as a woman, what I was always told growing up as a teenager is that my key to liberation was education. And please, please, please do not get pregnant, right? I always joke that the older I got as a teenager, the more restrictive my parents became. My curfew became earlier and earlier, and I had fewer freedoms, because it was really about, wanting to make sure that I didn't get pregnant. And so there was a lot of anxiety about, like, my own sexual development growing up from my parents. One side story about being sharecroppers on a tobacco farm, being Black sharecroppers in tobacco, was that Black tobacco farmers could not get the same prices as white tobacco farmers did. And so we had an arrangement with white neighbors who would sell our tobacco for us, so that we could, try to kind of eke out a living. And we sold our tobacco in Durham, North Carolina, very famous for the tobacco warehouses, which are now beautiful lofts and nice places to shop, but that's where my family sold their tobacco. But that is also when I turned 17 in Durham, North Carolina. Literally, maybe five blocks from where my family sold tobacco is where I had my first appointment out of Planned Parenthood, before I made the decision to become sexually active, so that I could make an informed decision about what to do with my body. So just even geographically, like, the sites of oppression can also be the sites of liberation. I consequently did not have my first child until I was 37, and she's a four-year-old amazing little girl that I am now able to fully be present with and take care of because of the privilege I had of being of having access to information and care and services. So I just want to share that with you before we launch into what we're doing here. All right. So I'm going to use my time to talk a little bit about defining what reproductive justice is. And how how we need to think about challenging reproductive oppression. So we're going to name that. We're going to talk a little bit about that, and really dig in on what it means to challenge oppression. And then if we have time, then we'll I want to talk a little bit about how my organization, Help Planned Parenthood, is attempting both internal culture change as well as how the framework of reproductive justice is helping us inform how we change our attitudes about healthcare delivery, what kind of services we offer, as well as how we do the advocacy for those services. All right, sound good? All right. So, what is reproductive justice? The reproductive justice framework, and I'm going to compare that to reproductive health, reproductive rights, and then reproductive justice. So, what is reproductive justice? It's something we call it RJ for short. This framework was crafted by a network of women of color over 20 years ago, or actually exactly 20 years ago this year, out of a need to think of, about reproductive health in a much more intersectional way than the traditional women's movement or pro-choice movement was addressing at that time. I think what was experienced, and certainly I sort of feel it now, being a woman of color in working at Planned Parenthood, is that focusing on access to services, I mean, that is necessary for sure. That is a critical component, but that doesn't speak to the lived experience of many, many women, particularly marginalized communities and women of color. So this is really about broadening the definition. No, that's right. It's hard to see. And again, when all people have the economic, social, and political power and resources to make healthy decisions about their bodies, then I think we can say that we've truly achieved reproductive justice or reproductive freedom. So it's really looking at, I think from a public health perspective, you all often talk about the social determinants of health. And I think that is, I think, another way to get at the intersectionality of the issues that impact people in their lived experience. But for a little bit of history, this term was first coined in 1994, so exactly 20 years ago, at the United Nations International Conference on Population and Development in Cairo. And what you saw there was women from the global south really challenging the traditional rights perspective and wanting to bring a more social justice frame into the conversation about how women in the lived experience is being addressed. So, you know, really coming out of the perspective of women of color constantly being blamed for overpopulation and challenging the notion of population control. Challenging folks for not engaging in the fight against poverty or for healthcare access. And also the ability for women of color to have children. Out of that, the women from the Global South attending that meeting in Cairo, out of that there were women from the women from the United States, many women of color, who then met, I believe, in a hotel room in Chicago. Billy, were you there? You were like there. You should be up here telling the story. but meeting in a hotel room in Chicago, and out of that, crafting what we now know in the United States as the reproductive justice movement. Both Cindy and I actually last, just a week and a half ago, had the honor and privilege of reconvening with many of those leaders from 10 years ago who sat in that hotel room and came up with the framework to talk about both, to celebrate, discuss the history of this, as well as what are the challenges and opportunities for our movement going forward. So we literally just had an anniversary, which is really nice. All right. Again, I think that this has been outlined fairly well, but I just want to sort of lay out very quickly how reproductive justice is a different bite at the apple from reproductive health and reproductive rights. So reproductive health is all about the access to services, the services that we provide. Now, Planned Parenthood, of course, we are squarely in the reproductive health frame as the largest abortion provider in the country, as one of the largest providers of sexual health education in the country, and as well as the many other types of reproductive health that we provide in our health centers, from HIV screening, from STD testing and treatment, to birth control and everything that we do. That is squarely in the reproductive health frame. And then reproductive rights. And I think that this is where I definitely can speak from my perspective, having been a Planned Parenthood over the last 10 years, where we have really grown our organizing capacity and our political work to, you know, we say, to keep our health centers open, to keep that access to healthcare, to reproductive health. That is really more about emphasizing the legal and constitutional protections to those services. Steadily eroding over the past, you know, I mean, we can say two decades, three decades, but I mean, sort of the slow march, as you all are well aware of. But that really only gets to the legal protections, and you know, part of the limitations with that is like, even if we were to achieve all of the legal protections, does that mean that women actually have access? If women are poor, if women are marginalized, if we aren't able to support our families, if there's still other coercive practices that keep women marginalized. So these frameworks are important, and I don't mean to dismiss them, but reproductive justice is, again, much broader and intersectional approach to thinking about what happens. I really love this picture that you see there on the right side. You deserve, because one of the tenets of reproductive justice is not just that you have the ability to delay having children, but that you also have the right to parent your children without fear without fear from violence, and raise them in a healthy way. I think about this particularly this week when we are waiting on what's going to happen in Missouri, and what the verdict will be against Darren Wilson. And that just highlights, I mean, just that singular moment highlights what we have seen across the country, particularly this summer. But, you know, those of us who live and work in these communities know that this happens all the time. The systematic, police brutality, and violence and murder of our young children, particularly of our young black men, is not just horrific, but it needs to be a significant concern of those of us who care about reproductive health rights and justice. Because if black women cannot raise their children in safety, that is a reproductive health problem. That is a reproductive rights problem. I'm getting the 5 minute mark, so we might have to skip across a little bit, because there are a couple of things that I definitely want to get to. Oh, you like that? You like that, huh? So let's talk about challenging reproductive oppression a little bit and what that looks like. And again, I probably feel like I'm speaking a little bit to the choir here, but again. And we're not going to be able to see this because that doesn't work. Reproductive oppression involves the complicity of governments, institutions, and individuals in controlling and exploiting our sexuality, the labor, and our reproduction. These are all tied. So we need to make sure that we link reproduction to our sexuality and the way that we move in the world. And so reproductive justice then becomes about liberating that, and making sure that people have all of the tools, all of the power and the resources to make healthy decisions about their bodies. So reproductive oppression, I think, occurs in a lot of different ways. We can look at economic marginalization. I saw a very interesting polling just this morning. So we, you know, we see in this current economy as we're sort of bouncing back from the people call the economic turndown from a few years ago. But really, who is benefiting right now in the way that our economy is bouncing back? People definitely feel that there is a business elite upper class that is gaining most of the benefit from the economic upturn, while as regular everyday people continue to suffer, continue to operate under low wage and being underemployed or unemployed. And the sad thing about that is, and I'm not going to get political here, even though those are my roots. I'm going to keep it C3 appropriate.
Why not?
but what in general what Americans are feeling is that the conservative rhetoric of the trickle-down economics, and that if we support business leaders and the job so-called job creators, that narrative to them, even though it seems mythical, that resonates more than what the narrative that the progressives are putting out in terms of economic justice, because they're not addressing it in a way that resonates with people. So Paul Krugman can talk about it in the New York Times, but it's not resonating with everyday folks. And that's why it's one of the reasons why we saw in the last election many people, many undecideds in particular, at the last minute, voting for more conservative Republican candidates, and that part of the wave that we saw in the last election a few days ago. So, again, the economic marginalization is real and one of the ways that that we are oppressed. There's also the political subordination. So disenfranchising people and denying them access to the political process and the policymaking process. We see that writ large and have over the last decade with the proliferation of voter ID laws and other restrictions to access to the ballot box. But even historically, when we think about how redistricting and gerrymandering have consolidated power over the last decade, and the fact that once you're in, sort of the hegemony of incumbency, once you're in, it's hard to get you out. It's hard to make any changes there. So it really consolidates political power, and therefore the ability to make decisions around those. The assimilation piece, I think, is really about culture and how people are represented in popular culture. And we see a direct correlation between how people are portrayed in the media and then what people's perceptions are. And we particularly see this with people of color. The perpetration of violence, we already talked a little bit about police brutality. I think that even to a further extent, that's tied to the larger trends of militarization and the creation of a police state. And actually, that's also really tied to culture. So I sat in on an interesting panel with Issa Rae and Dream Hampton a few days ago in Dallas at the Facing Race Conference. Mm-hmm. And they talked about how if you look at what is on television right now and some of the most popular shows and even the most popular characters, they are all agents of the state. If you think about all of the police dramas that are so popular. Oh, 1 minute. I'm not even... All right, moving along. Anyway, perpetuation of violence, particularly violence by the state, police state. We can talk about more about that after the panel is over. And then control of gender and sexuality. This may be the one place where we're moving the ball in the other direction, because the conversation is definitely opening and broadening about gender and sexuality. I would posit, still in a little bit of a conservative frame, particularly as it relates to the conversation around same-sex marriage. That's a comfortable place for people to have the conversation because it's in a framework that they can recognize. But there has been, I believe, some opening and some broadening of that. But definitely the control of bodies is definitely tied to controlling gender, sexuality, and sexual expression. And again, the regulation of families. Okay, how am I going to wrap this up? I have so many more slides to go.
It's kind of that time.
All right. We We talk about, again, the limitations of the choice framework and wanting to broaden that. Choice is a response to taking away rights. Choice also assumes that you have options to begin with, to choose from, where justice is really a response to oppression by seeking liberation. Ask me about this slide afterwards. But there are consistently, this is just sort of latest polling, but this has actually been tracking, I think, for the last 20 years. There are always going to be folks who identify as solidly pro-choice and folks who identify as solidly anti-choice or pro-life, quote unquote. But if you talk about access to healthcare and access to services, that allows you to broaden the conversation a little bit. And I want to talk about that sweet spot of the green 13%. And I think I'm getting booted, so sorry, I took so long. Thank you.
I'm so sorry.